Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Financial Services and E-Commerce Practice Group, was recorded on Friday, December 22, 2017, during a live Teleform conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's Teleform conference call, as today we discuss succession and litigation at the CFPB. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, General Counsel, and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future and might well be transcribed. Professor John Eastman is our guest today. He's the Henry Salvatore Professor of Law and Community Service and Director of the Center for Constitutional Jurisprudence at the Dale E. Fowler School of Law at Chapman University in Southern California. He's joining us live from Southern California today, this morning, I suppose, in California time. But a repeat guest, Professor and Dean Eastman, thank you so much for joining us. The floor is yours.
Dean, thank you very much. And let me also give a nod to the sponsor of our Center for Constitutional Jurisprudence, the Claremont Institute, graciously allows me to do the litigation work under their umbrella while I'm engaging in my teaching jobs and duties at Chapman University. We're going to talk today about the CFPB. That's Washington speak, of course, for the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau. This is the radically unconstitutional, I know I'm supposed to be neutral here in the opening setup, but the radically unconstitutional entity that was set up as part of the 2010 massive Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act. It was the brainchild of then Harvard Law professor, now Senator Elizabeth Warren, and President Obama tapped her to be the special advisor to the Secretary of the Treasury back in those days to create this agency, to set it up under the authority of the Dodd-Frank Act. But he passed her over for the nod to be the head of the agency, and that instead went to a fellow by the name of Richard Cordray, who was then Treasurer of Ohio. Now, this agency drew a lot of Republican opposition basically because of its structure, and that opposition took the form of opposition to Cordray's confirmation and a filibustering of that in order to leverage Republican strength to force some changes to the agency that would address its constitutional infirmities. Those included restrictions on the president's ability to remove the director. It's arguably in violation of his Article II powers as head of the executive branch. The agency's perpetual self-funding mechanisms, it gets to impose fines on its regulated agencies as a way to fund itself, so without ever having to go back to the House of Representatives for funding, likely in violation of the Constitution's requirement that all taxes be approved by Congress and they must originate in the House of Representatives and expenditures be made by appropriations passed by Congress. And also the director's ability to appoint inferior officers to the agency, and that violates, I think, the Appointments Clause. That's the one that's at issue here on this eve of the next holiday, Christmas. What Mr. Cordray did on the eve, on the day after Thanksgiving, on that Friday when nobody's looking. And on that day, President Obama ultimately appointed Richard Cordray as director in violation of the Senate's confirmation process, using the recess appointments clause when the Senate was not in recess, the Supreme Court unanimously held that move was unconstitutional when he made it with the National Labor Relations Board. But Cordray was then subsequently confirmed by the Senate for a five-year term, and that term was set to expire next summer of 2018. And of course, that wouldn't do because President Trump and the party now in charge of the Senate are both hostile to many of the regulatory agendas that are coming out of this agency. And so what Richard Cordray did instead was resign. And on his way out the door on the day after Thanksgiving, he appointed his chief of staff, Leandra English, as the deputy director, and then she then laid claim to the director position because it was now vacant, and in Cordray's absence, she claimed that she was director. President Trump thought otherwise, and he named his own acting director and under the Federal Vacancies Act. And here I think the language, we're going to get into the language of the statute a little bit, and then I'm going to circle back around to this constitutional infirmities on some of the arguments being pressed out there. So there is language in the Dodd-Frank Act that created the CFPB that says the deputy director will perform the duties of acting director when in the absence or unavailability of the director. And it's that language that the deputy director appointed on Mr. Cordray's way out the door claimed to be the new director. Now, a couple problems with that. There are a lot of other federal agencies that have similar language in their statutory charters, but that language has uniformly been interpreted as allowing the deputy director to perform the duties of the agency when the director is temporarily unavailable, not when the office itself is vacant. For vacancies, these other statutes have different language. The National Bank Act, for example, says that during a vacancy in the office or during the absence or disability of the controller, each deputy controller has the powers of the controller. Similarly, the deputy director of the Office of Management and Budget is authorized to serve as the director when the director is absent or unable to serve. That's the language that follows the CFPB language. Then it has this added clause, or when the office of the director is vacant. Same's true over at the Federal Aviation Administration. The deputy administrator can perform the duties of the administrator when the administrator is absent or unable to serve, or when the office of the administrator is vacant. That last clause is language that doesn't exist in the CFPB statute. And so what you see is that there is direct language that covers a temporary unavailability, and then separate language in many statutes when the office itself is vacant. Because of the omission of that language in the CFPB statute, I think it's quite clear that a vacancy is not ground for a deputy director assuming the role of director in the acting capacity. Now, even if that weren't the case, though, and we could stretch the CFPB language broadly enough to allow the deputy director to effectively be appointed as the outgoing director's successor without any involvement by president or the Senate, that interpretation would be constitutionally suspect. Everybody agrees that the deputy director is not a mere employee, but rather an inferior officer. So the Appointments Clause of the Constitution applies. Now, the default provision in the Appointments Clause is that for inferior officers, just like principal officers, the president nominates and the Senate gives its advice and consent or confirms. But there's an alternative mechanism that can be set out by law for inferior officers, and the appointment of such inferior officers can be vested in one of three different entities: the president alone, in other words, without the Senate confirmation process, or in the courts of law, as was the case with the independent prosecutor, or, quote, in the heads of departments, if the statute so provides. And this statute does so provide. It claims that the director of the CFPB is a head of department and therefore can have the authority to appoint the deputy director without any presidential involvement or without Senate confirmation. But the CFPB is not a department. It's a sub-agency housed in the Federal Reserve System, and so it's very unlikely that it would qualify as a department for constitutional authority to delegate the appointment of deputy directors to the director of the CFPB. Existing case law hasn't settled the precise nature of that line, but it strongly suggests that the head of the CFPB or similar sub-agencies is not the head of a department. And if that's true, as I believe it is, Richard Cordray had no constitutional authority to appoint Leandra English as his deputy director, and therefore she would have no constitutional authority to step in as a successor in his absence or unavailability, even if that statutory phrase could be stretched to cover vacancies. Now, let me just kind of close with a bigger picture here and why this lawsuit and the controversy swirling around control of this agency has become so big. What we really have here is a long-standing goal of the 100-year-long progressive movement to create governing agencies that are simply not accountable to elected officials. The CFPB is a progressive nirvana on that score, as I wrote in an article I published out in the Los Angeles Daily Journal. There's a single director rather than a commission who, once appointed, it can be removed only for cause and therefore can operate largely free of the supervision from the elected president, and who, through fines he imposes himself on the regulated industries, he can even operate free of congressional oversight that normally comes with the annual appropriation process that every other agency in town must go through. This is what you might call the swamp on steroids. And Cordray's bald move to make it a self-perpetuating swamp makes the matter even worse. This litigation that Leandra English filed, therefore, to claim that she's the rightful director of the agency and that the president has no authority to supervise it, to make his own appointments under the Vacancies Act or otherwise, is really a bald-faced attempt to create self-perpetuating agencies that run regulatory regimes of massive authority and massive ability to interfere with the private markets in this country without any political oversight whatsoever. So it's an extremely important litigation. Ms. English lost the first rounds, and I confess I've not paid attention over the last week or two to what the most recent developments have been. Maybe somebody on the call can update all of us on it. But we ought to pay attention to this, because this is a canary in the closet. This is more than a canary in the closet. It's an 800-pound gorilla in the closet of this trying to attempt to create a regulatory state that is unremovable, unaccountable, that is self-perpetuating and self-funding. It is no longer a government by the people, for the people. It is a government run amok. So that's the broad parameters of what's going on here. And with that, I will stop and see if we have any questions.
Terrific. Well, thank you so much, Professor. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We've got quite a few callers on the line. Our lines are wide open. We've budgeted a full hour for this call, but we'll adjourn early if we don't get a number of questions to sustain our call. But let me get things started. You've characterized the CFPB as a lot of our other folks have. What's the best case that you can make that the CFPB is just sort of business as usual, that this is exactly what we want in an administrative agency, that in the wake of the 2008 financial collapse, it was decided by Congress, elected officials, that the financial regulators were not up to the task. We needed a special new entity, and it needed to be insulated from precisely the pressures that the existing regime was susceptible to. That is, the Wall Street interests had found the regulating entities. They were lobbying them mercilessly. We need to set up a special sort of deliberately unaccountable entity to police financial institutions for the benefit of consumers.
Well, I mean, it's a very good question, Dean, but I think it assumes some things that are what the trial lawyer in me says are facts, not in evidence. What we do know of the 2008 scandal is that the thing was originated not by the regulated entities lobbying the government agencies, but quite frankly, the government agencies pushing an agenda that was likely to lead to collapse. We see demands coming out of Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and the regulators that the private mortgage markets be writing mortgages to folks that everybody knew were not capable, financially capable, of making good on their notes. Now, what happened with those demands of the regulated industry is that they figured out a way to try and market the products that they were being forced to provide in a way that could make them some money. That's, you know, private business needs to make money. But the demands, the thing that the pressure came from the government rather than the other way around to enter into these risky loans. So if that's true, and I believe it is, the notion that the government that caused the problem is going to be the salvation and solve the problem going forward by creating even less oversight of the shenanigans that tend to come from these unsupervised and unelected government agencies, I think gets it exactly wrong. We're much more likely with an agency like this to create an even bigger bubble that will bust, that will wreak even more havoc on the economy. Because they tend to pursue agendas that are unrelated to the reality of the economic world. And the CFPB is a perfect example of that. So I do think that there may have been some folks that thought having a CFPB would solve the problems of the financial industry, but they're running with rose-colored glasses on, and you know the founders of this country understood that when you put this kind of unsupervised power in the hands of a single agency, much less in the hands of a single person, you're going to tend to find that power gets abused. We find that over and over and over again, repeated in history, as one of a kind of a core flaws of human nature. And I don't see anything in the CFPB that would counsel against that long historical understanding of human nature. And in fact, what we see here with Richard Cordray's parting shot, an attempt to perpetuate himself to guarantee that he's free, not just during his tenure, but permanently, that this agency runs on autopilot forevermore without any control from the political authorities or from the sovereign American people, I think proves that old act and adage, absolute power corrupts, absolutely.
Once again, if you have a question, we're speaking with Professor John Eastman. Push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got two callers in the queue. Push the star button, pound button, if you'd like to join the queue. For now, let's take our first call of the day.
Hi, this is Bill James with JPODS. And one of the things that I think from a federalism point of view is the states are supposed to be sovereign over commerce, where the federal government is only sovereign over commercial things that build paths to war. If the states taxed and funded the entity, the federal entity, and the federal entity was then accountable to state governments for the efficacy of the programs, wouldn't that add a layer of enforcement that's currently missing?
Well, yes and no. First, I kind of want to one of the issues here we have is the your opening assumption that the states are have control or authority over commerce, particularly with these interstate transactions that the modern financial markets occur. I don't think that's true, and I'm about as stingy a read on the federal constitutional authority over interstate commerce as you're going to find in the country. But international financial trade markets, unless we're going to go back to the notion, as Justice Thomas has suggested, that trade is that commerce is only the trade, that financial transactions would not qualify, which I think there's only one vote on that proposition on the Supreme Court, that I do think there is some regulatory authority and Congress's power to regulate interstate commerce. The problems are broader and different than that here. The problem is if you acknowledge that point, then how we go about doing that is a process that also needs to have political accountability, and this CFPB has none. From its ability to issue law under regulations that without any substantial direction or intelligible principle from Congress, that violates the non-delegation doctrine, the Article I requirement that all legislative power is vested in Congress. To its ability, you know, to act without supervision, to be removed only for cause, that takes the president's appointment power out of the process. To its ability to impose fines, to conduct hearings, to impose sentences effectively on regulated entities without going through the due process requirements and the judiciary as required under Article 3. This thing is a separation of powers travesty. Now, and if you then add in, as I think you would like to do, and I'll push us or go along with this as far as I think I can or think the existing case law does, the federalism aspect, they're not just regulating interstate transactions. They're regulating a lot of things that happen entirely within a state. How much a bank in California can charge its customers in California for an ATM transaction that occurs entirely in California. I would love to see those aspects of the CFPB's regulatory regime and the banking laws of Congress cut back as exceeding Congress's power under the Commerce Clause as well. And so you add all of that together, we have a massive constitutional violation problem here with this agency, and the courts have only begun to scratch the surface of those problems.
On that, if you're interested, we're going to sue the federal government over the post-roads restriction, where the federal government isn't supposed to build roads and Hyperloop and J-Pods and a whole bunch of what is going to be known as the physical internet are going to displace an awful lot of federal programs. And I agree with you that the regulatory framework should be managed by the federal government, but the funding of it and the accounting and the taxing to fund it, I think, should be state sovereignty. And then the states, the federal agencies, must account to the state governments for some kind of a panel of state governments to assure that the federal government isn't mixing warp-making powers with commercial self-interest.
Well, yeah, that's certainly a proposal that I think Congress could entertain. I will say this though: the existing funding mechanism, as I noted in my opening remarks, I think is itself unconstitutional. The notion that you can create an agency that then has its own power to impose taxes through fines and make expenditures without any annual appropriation from Congress violates the restrictions in the spending clause in Article 1. It violates the restrictions in Article 1, Section 9, that no monies can be drawn from the Treasury in the absence of an appropriation by law. And yet this agency was deliberately set up so it didn't have to go through the annual appropriations process, that it could pass regulations, the violation of which would lead to fines, that it could self-impose, self-prosecute, and then self-adjudicate. I mean, James Madison and his reliance on the Baron de Montesquieu are both rolling over in their graves at this violation of separation of powers.
Well, this is Dean. Let me interject there. How does that differ from other agencies that collect fees, sometimes after even setting the rates, and not just from a bank here or there, not just based on bad behavior, but from, everyone who has a cell phone, for example, or everyone who has a landline telephone?
Well, a lot of those agencies that collect those fees, the fees go directly into the general treasury, and then they get their expenditures paid out of an annual appropriation. This agency gets to collect the fees and put it in its own bank account and then spend it at its own will without any further involvement of Congress. That's where the violation occurs. Normally, if there's a tax imposed on a cell phone license, that money goes into the general treasury, and the draw from the general treasury then is a function of what the annual appropriation approved by Congress in the procedure set out in Article 1, Section 7, and consistent with the restrictions in Article 1, Section 9 are.
So this situation, this is Dean again, is more akin to the Mayberry RFD judge who prosecutes tickets for speeders coming through his neighborhood, but then gets to put the cash in his own budget.
In his own bank account, yeah. Now you might say, okay, in the small town, there may not be much difference in practice. In reality, when the city council tells him, if we don't get another $100,000 in traffic fines this year, we're going to have to cut your salary. But it nevertheless remains one step removed. That traffic fine goes into the general treasury. The general treasury is then paid out of an annual appropriation that goes to cover the expenses of the city. Here we've we've eliminated even that middle step. I get to put the money directly into my own bank account. It's therefore not subject to the oversight of Congress on the appropriation, and it's not in compliance with the prohibition in Article 1, Section 9 that no monies can be drawn from the federal treasury in the absence of an appropriation by law. This agency is drawing monies. The monies are not even going into the treasury, and yet they are U.S. taxpayer funds because this is not a private entity. Any money it raises is U.S. taxpayer funds, but it is being given to their own bank account without having to go through the appropriations process, and that's what I think is unconstitutional in the funding aspect of this. Now, I welcome this litigation because we're going to be able to look at now through the crucible of the litigation process the constitutional infirmities that have been glossed over since this agency was created back in 2010, and I hope it's the first thread of a loose thread on a sweater that just comes completely unraveled as a result of what Mr. Cordray did on his parting shot here.
We've got just one question pending in our audience. If you'd like to join, actually two now. So, but if you'd like to join the queue, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Take another question from a caller.
Yeah, well, happy holidays. This is Mike Doherty in Atlanta. Of course, I always have a keen interest in anything that's going to chat about the administrative state. And to me, the CFPB is just a steroid example. It's like the new and improved latest version. And it just shows the outrageous, courage, to put it politely, of the people that dare to put something like this together. But they do so because while the lawyers might understand it, maybe, and the people scheming to create it know exactly what their loophole they're trying to stretch, people that aren't impacted by this are completely, almost in disbelief that this structure has been going on for a century. So how do and the judicial process at this point, I hope, will finally do something instead of endorse and support Congress just by defaulting to Congress. But how do you think we actually work against this outside of lawsuits? It's at a tipping point, I think, but you still have the political process where you've got senators getting on television screaming that we're all going to die because the CFPB is not going to exist anymore, and that does intimidate some people in the political system from talking about this.
Well, yeah. So a couple of things, and I don't think these are mutually exclusive. I do think you needed both a litigation strategy and a political strategy. The litigation strategy needed to start pushing back on some of the Supreme Court's doctrines of deference to unelected administrative agencies. My own Center for Constitutional Jurisprudence started pushing on those issues about a decade ago. And it's gotten a lot of traction to the point where, the Federalist Society's annual convention this year focused almost entirely on these non-delegation and deference doctrine issues and the creation of this unelected, unaccountable monster of an administrative state. And I don't think that would have happened if Justice Thomas, for example, hadn't started putting in some of his opinions, we've got to revisit some of these delegation doctrines, some of these deference doctrines. Justice Scalia, who was the author of one of them, the so-called Auer deference, A-U-E-R, deference doctrine, where the courts were deferring to an agency's interpretations of its own regulations that were interpreting loosely some very vague and fuzzy, ambiguous statutory language that effectively made the executive agency, the unaccountable executive agency, the lawmaker, the executor, and the judge and jury all at once. And Justice Scalia, slightly before his death, said he was prepared to overrule that doctrine that he himself had helped author. And his successor in that seat on the Supreme Court, Neil Gorsuch, was already, as a lower court judge, grappling with those issues. So I do think the door has opened for a major transformation in how we think about the unelected executive bureaucracy or administrative agency bureaucracy. And I think that discussion now underway was prompted by those litigation efforts. The second thing is, you're right, there needs to be a political solution. And you know, oh, we're going to get rid of the CFPB or you know, make it bound by the constitutional rules that just handcuff agencies. You know, modern life is more complicated than it was for James Madison and Thomas Jefferson. We need modern solutions. And if you restrict the CFPB, then people are going to get charged ATM bank fees again. And that'll send half of the Senate scurrying to the hills to avoid that demagoguery. You know, so the two responses to that. One, I think reminding Congress that the buck stops with it, and that it cannot create these unelected, unaccountable agencies with vague delegations of power to do whatever they want. That the hard calls have to be made by Congress, and as the Supreme Court starts indicating that it will enforce the non-delegation doctrine, that says Congress has to be the one that passed laws and it can't delegate that lawmaking authority to anybody else, then I think you're going to see just not any increased spine, but of necessity, Congress starting to take on or retake more of its constitutional authority and responsibility. And at the forefront of that political effort, I think, again, the Federalist Society's Article One project. But I think we also need a broader effort, which is to counteract the public policy consequences of Congress figuring out that they can exercise a lot of power behind the scenes if they do these delegations of authority, and they can do it out of the public view through their appropriation process and a phone call to the director. You don't do what I want, we're going to slash your budget. Type of thing, without having to take a responsibility for the catastrophic consequences that come from these bad policies a lot of times. In fact, it's even worse than that. Congress has figured out how to make burdensome regulations the coin of their reelection realm. They pass these vague laws, they let the regulatory agencies run amok, and then if you've donated enough to the campaign, they will help you get an exemption from the regulations that are shutting down your competitors. And it seems to me that unholy alliance that has occurred in this regulatory state, that we're only going to fix that with the antiseptic that sunshine can provide. And one of the beauties of modern communications and social media and the internet is that it's much easier to shine light on those kind of scams than used to be the case. And I think if we start shining light on that, and you get some member of a appropriation subcommittee who's become, you know, running a fiefdom and collecting campaign contributions because he can help get people waivers from burdensome regulations that don't apply to the rest, we shine light on that and we start connecting the dots, and I think a lot of these problems can be solved. It's not going to be easy. These things never are. But it seems to me that the path is open for us to at least start making some advancements on that front.
Feels to me, John, like somebody ought to write a book about it. But.
Yeah, in the spare time.
Once again, we're speaking with Professor John Eastman. If you'd like to ask a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got just one question pending, then our lines are wide open. Go right ahead, caller.
Hi, this is Roger Candelaria. Thank you, Professor and Dean, for a really super presentation today. I've been trying to figure out if there's a way to get some mileage out of the Fifth Amendment, conceivably the Fourth, where what's the enforcement mechanism? Let's say that some independent agency finds you. Do they have their own troops to go out and collect the money, or could other agencies that are legitimate stand by and refuse to do it, saying that's an unlawful taking of private property, and refuse to participate?
Well, I think the Supreme Court is starting to look at a version of this problem by opening the door to questioning whether Article One administrative law judges can do things that I think the Constitution properly assigns and requires can only be done by Article III judges. Those cases that are kind of percolating right now don't involve the CFPB, but the principles at issue there, I think, can set some can level the playing field on the type of concern you've raised, and I think it's a serious one. It simply does not comply with due process for the agency to pass its own law, to enforce its own law, and then to adjudicate its own law against the person that it passed it to fine, and then reap the benefits of the funding from it. I mean, there are half a dozen Fourth Amendment or Fifth Amendment violations in that scheme, and it seems to me that the courts weighing in on some of those issues, like the Article I administrative law judges, is going to start laying the groundwork that we can take to folks who are on the receiving end of some of this unconstitutional fining to challenge the CFP orders itself.
What's the mechanism by which they collect the fines?
I don't know the answer to that. I suspect. They issue an order, and you know, if you're a businessman that's just been fined, do you want to buy a multi-million-dollar, multi-year litigation, or do you want to pay the $100,000 fine and be done with it? If you challenge, you know, stand on challenging their authority to impose the fine or the mechanism by which they're collecting the fine, you're buying yourself a whole heap of trouble. And so it takes a rather courageous folk on the losing side of that fine fight to really stand up. One of the reasons the public interest law movement is now starting to look at these things is they understand the difficulty that these regulated entities are in, because they've got to be repeat players with that regulated entity, and if they kick up a lot of dust, they're kind of on the target list, and you know, not too many people want to do that. So you get trade associations and public interest law firms that are fighting back against this stuff to maybe give them enough cover that we can start pushing back against this.
Thank you.
We've got time for more questions. No callers on the board with a question. Push the star button, then the pound button if you have a question. Professor Eastman, just two comments that I'd make. One, for our caller's benefit, I suppose, there is a D.C. Circuit Court case, the name of which escapes me, testing the constitutionality of administrative law judges in the Securities and Exchange Commission. There is also the Supreme Court case this term already argued, not yet decided. That's the Oil States case, which is looking at the Patent Trial Advisory Board, which purports to have the authority to invalidate patents after they've been granted. So that's sort of an internal process that amounts, Roger Candelera, to really a taking of property. At least some people are making that argument.
Right. Those were the two cases I was thinking of, but thank you for elaborating, because I couldn't remember exactly which which agencies were involved. I am always we need to create, you know, like a big Powerball game and reach in and pull out any four letters in the alphabet and see how many different executive agency acronyms you can make out of those four letters. And my guess is you couldn't pull out any four letters without being able to make at least a dozen.
Yes, there are sadly no winners in that game, John.
Yeah, exactly.
Let me make a final call for questions. If you have a question, now is the time. Push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Okay, we do have another question, so see if we can head to area code 501. Go ahead, caller.
Oh, this is Walter. I actually work for the Army, and I do a little bit of finance and fiscal law work. What is the CFPB's role like? How do they get around all these fiscal law issues that are related, such as the Anti-Deficiency Act and all these other assorted laws about spending money? That,
well,
I think that's kind of how they can get around these issues.
Yeah, you know, I've not looked at the full statutory subprovision of the Dodd-Frank Act that created the CFPB, but I suspect there's probably in their language that sets up its own self-perpetuating funding mechanism with the phrase "other laws to the contrary notwithstanding" or something like that. So the statute itself is what's created this exemption for it from following what is the normal appropriations process is what I suspect we would find there, and the question is, to me, not whether the statute created that thing. I think that was particularly their intent, but whether in creating it they have violated pretty specific prohibitions in the Constitution on doing just that thing.
Very good. Let me make another final call for questions. Push the star button and then a pound button. Okay. Well, Professor Eastman, thank you so much for joining us as we head into the holidays. We certainly appreciate your time and your insights in this matter. I want to thank the audience as well for joining us. A reminder to our audience to check your emails and check out our website for notices of upcoming Teleforum conference calls. Wish everybody a Merry Christmas and Happy Holidays. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.